This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. OMG, time so flies. As of Friday, only 627 days remain until the 2020 presidential election, which means reporters, editors, anchors, and pundits are running out of time to speculate, trivialize, and marginalize, to be baited by irrelevancies, and to otherwise miss the forest for the clicks. But they've already got a head start. With at least a half dozen women in the running for the Democratic nomination, the media ether already abounds with nonsensical tropes.
Bernie's everything Warren is, but better. He's more energizing, more unifying, certainly more authentic.
Gillibrand is very politically ambitious. That's fine. She's without a doubt going to run for president.
The question really is, not can a female win for president, but can a female beat Trump?
Scholars have long since established measurable biases and double standards in the perception of women holding and seeking power. But now, in the Me Too age and in the wake of the midterm election's surge of women into the House of Representatives, the news media have a chance to choose new habits over old ones. And so we bring you this breaking news Consumer's Handbook, Gender and Politics edition. First on the list, the flawed and fraught metric of likeability.
The model of political leadership for a long time has been, do you want to have a beer with this presidential candidate? And that's a strange standard and one that probably ought to be interrogated, but it's also one that's not very available to high-achieving women who, for a variety of reasons, don't fit into that easygoing image, in large part because it's not available to them. And so because Hillary Clinton, I think, has been the main instance of what female political leadership could hypothetically look like in the United States, the fixation on her inability to fit into that paradigm of having a beer with the bros has sort of filtered into our concept of what a presidential candidate ought to be and can never be if she's female.
And yet, here was the first question that U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was asked as a presidential candidate.
I think a lot of people see you as pretty likable. How much is a selling point, like an 80 fluence hour, Kirsten Gillibrand, that maybe the country wants someone like that now?
I think that actually invites the candidate to speculate in kind of a meta way about her own personality, which just instantly renders a person unlikable.
It's a trap. You know?
Yeah, it is a trap.
Now, almost by definition, candidates for public office as a group are ambitious and self-absorbed, sometimes to a pathological degree. But when a woman displays these traits, she somehow is Lady Macbeth.
Yeah, she certainly is. And if she's not, that's in some ways even more suspicious because it means that she's successfully masking it. I think Clinton kind of had it coming from both sides. She was both seen as conniving, calculating, secretive, and manipulative. But also, when there was nothing that could be said about, for example, abusing her staff, that too could be read as well. You know, she knew that she had to keep up the veneer, even in private contexts. You know, in other words, there is no way for female ambition, I think, to be read as straightforward, honest, and healthy.
Now, I almost hesitate to belabor the obvious, but there is also wardrobe fixation. Even if that's unusually blatant, the phenomenon of, you know, what does she look like? How is she dressed? It is always the elephant in the room.
I think what's very interesting about this moment and what gives me a lot of hope is that the midterm elections have produced this unprecedented abundance of women in the House. expanding our visual sense of what female leadership can look like and what the intersection between vanity, image, and political effectiveness can be.
Nonetheless, you still believe the culture is rigged against women. You've said that even popularity can redound against perceptions of seriousness. You talk about fandom and the double-edged sword that that represents.
We have so little practice relating to female political leaders that it sometimes slips over into the language of fandom, which I think is dangerous. Fandom is functionally, I think, diminishing to someone's perceived political seriousness. I will say that Ocasio-Cortez has been threading that needle in ways I find completely fascinating. She is young enough to have grown up being entirely fluent in the language of self-conscious self-presentation that older candidates sometimes falter at. She's managed to articulate a vision of female political leadership that is actually fun. She might be the female candidate that people do want to have a beer with. She's made that thinkable.
There was an episode where someone dug up the college YouTube video that they did, Dancing on a Rooftop. It was treated in the right-wing media as scandalous. She certainly flipped that to her advantage because people thought it was charming. There was a much more toxic example of using a woman's past against her, and that came with Kamala Harris.
For those of you who aren't familiar with our friend Kamala, let me give you just a little bit of background. She entered the California political scene in the early 90s. She was fresh out of law school and working at the Amita County District Attorney's Office. Then enters her boo, Willie Brown. He was once the Speaker of the California State Assembly and Mayor of San Francisco. Over the weekend, the former San Fran mayor admitted to having an extramarital affair with young Kamala, pulling her out of obscurity and elevating her political career.
I think that it's just so clear that everyone who basically makes it up the ladder in politics has been helped in deeply inappropriate ways that I'm not sure that gendered smear is really taking root, which I was interested to observe. I don't know if you agree with that, but that was my sense.
You know, I think maybe there is reason for hope. But in the meantime, can we just look at the Amy Klobuchar situation? Evidently, she's a terrible boss. There's a lot of testimony to that effect. Berates employees, throws things, manages by humiliation, and so forth.
I am tough. I push people. That is true. But my point is that I have high expectations for myself. I have high expectations for the people that work for me. And I have high expectations for this country.
Now, temperament is, and always has been, fair game to evaluate candidates. Is this out of proportion to the way men are who fly off the handle?
I think that there is a real danger in calling any criticism of a female candidate sexist, not just because that's unfair and inappropriate, but because you also kneecap that candidate by making her seem fragile. To the extent that labor matters and that the rights of labor matter and that Democrats and those on the left prioritize human dignity in the workplace. Those are pretty disqualifying traits. You know, I think those are entirely fair criticisms. I think, too, that playing into a pretty available stereotype of women as duplicitous, right? I mean, Klobuchar's reputation was as being very Minnesota nice. I mean, and, you know, in the Kavanaugh hearing, certainly she was a figure of apparent equanimity. So it's distressing, right, to find confirmation of something that I think is very easily attributed to other women. But if it's real, it's real. You know, I don't think there's anything to be gained by pretending that those things aren't true.
We've been talking about journalistic tropes. And, you know, one that certainly characterizes every race is horse race coverage, to ignore policy, to ignore the actual institutions of government, and just focus on electability. But even that seems to work to the disadvantage of female candidates, no?
What I think horse race coverage does is promote a tendency wherein the pundit ventriloquizes the worst aspects of American nature, so sexist, racist, etc., and then, taking all of that for granted, speculates on the chances of that voter overcoming all of those biases in order to elect a particular person. So that is always going to make female candidates, minority candidates, seem weaker and less electable for the simple reason that we have not historically elected people like that. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, I think, where that has become the dominant mode of American reporting. Electability is the only relevant consideration. So it just produces a circle where there ought to be discussion of policy and what American people actually need.
This conversation is for a Breaking News Consumer's Handbook, which is our ongoing checklist of things for the media literate to keep their eyes open for, to understand that the media doing the reporting are doing them justice. But, you know, it may be actually a dubious premise, because it presumes that if journalists were just doing a little bit better, that we would be better able to be making sound, informed decisions. But in this case, it really isn't just flawed coverage. These are prejudices and double standards that afflict the entire culture. I wonder if the last checklist item on the consumer's handbook should be physician, heal thyself. You are responsible for what you bring to the table as well.
We believe ourselves to be rational consumers and rational actors, and I think we all like to think that we're fair-minded and weigh the evidence and make decisions accordingly. If cognitive science has shown us anything, it's that we are quite blind, in fact, to our own decision-making processes and very good at rationalizing our decisions after the fact. But often we're reconstructing a line of reasoning that isn't actually what led us to that conclusion. And that is hard to confront, and it is largely a function of bias, of implicit bias, but it's also the fact that first impressions have just been shown to enormously shape someone's idea of a person or a political issue. New facts don't actually cause us to refute those beliefs very often. It's not just that we're tribal. It's not just that partisanship is at an all-time high. It's that this is kind of like a flaw in the human brain, that, you know, that the need to collaborate and like link up with members of our tribe leads us to frequently overlook evidence that might, in a truly rational system, persuade us of the opposite case. So correcting for that is just an ongoing challenge. And I think requires, among other things, realizing the ways that we gravitate towards news coverage that confirms what we want to hear. And specifically, I think, horse race coverage that encourages us to think that our side will win.
Lily, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for chatting with me, Bob.
Lily Loofborough is a staff writer at Slate. You can view our Breaking News Consumer's Handbook, Gender and Politics edition, at onthemedia.org.
Coming up, depictions of the tabloid vixens of the 90s undergo some overdue revision.
This is On the Media.